Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is musician, producer, composer, and radio host Ben Vaughn. Vaughn has just released the initial episode of his new podcast series, Straight from the Hat with Ben Vaughn. The biweekly episodes cover the collaborations and experiences he's had across his multi-decades musical career. Co-host Laura Pocadello pulls a name from a hat, which spurs Vaughn to recall details about the relationship he had with that particular musical figure. We chatted about the podcast, as well as Vaughn's time composing for television, including his work on the NBC sitcom Third Rock from the Sun. That's Ben Vaughn on Into Music, coming up now.
First thing I want to mention is that I love Wichita. I've played there many times. Back in the 80s and the 90s, I played at a place. What was the name of that place? It was an old dance hall next to the Rock Court Motel, yep. The Coyote Club. The Coyote Club.
Yep.
And we would stay at the Rock Court Motel. And I felt like a rock star because my road manager would come over from the club and say, 5 minutes, Mr. Vaughn. And I would walk from my motel room onto the stage. The only time in my life that's ever happened. And it happened in Wichita. I was a big shot in Wichita.
Yeah, I've talked to so many people over the years who had the pleasure of staying there. And Art Bush, who was the owner for many years. He left and became a real estate agent. And I was buying a house from him. And I said, hey, I just have to know one thing. I said, is it true that you pulled the plug on the replacements?
Did he?
Yeah. He said, some people are nice when they're drinking. Some people aren't.
that's a very measured way of describing them. Yes.
So, I was like, I bought a house from a guy who pulled the plug on the replacements. Awesome.
Wow. What I remember is I played there on Thanksgiving Eve, and it was really nuts. It was packed and it was really nuts. And at the end of the night, I went in to use the bathroom, and one of the urinals had been ripped off the wall. And I said to Art, I said, wow. And he goes, yeah, that means they really liked you. That hasn't happened in at least 6 months.
So this is the kind of thing, actually, that sort of brings us to the podcast, because this is really a lot about you telling these stories that you have stored up from all your years in music. And what was kind of the inspiration or the initial spark for this?
The initial spark, I was working with Laura Pocadello. She is she basically runs Sun Records in Nashville. And she's very young, but her appreciation of older music. We were working on a project together. It was the 70th anniversary of Sun Records. And I was hired to curate a collection to put out on vinyl of things, you know, from the Sun catalog. And she was assigned to me to help me promote it. And we got to talking and we realized that we were both in love with the same kind of music. Sonny Bono being the number one thing that we bonded on. We both take him seriously. We know it gets a laugh. And we laugh too, but our love for his music is 100%, is not ironic. It's not ironic. And to find someone like that, and she also knew all of his history before Sonny and Cher working with Phil Spector and all that stuff. We bonded and started talking about music, and she was fascinated that I was actually alive when this music was new. And not only did I have experience hearing some of this stuff on the radio or finding these records at record stores in 1970 or whenever, I actually worked with a lot of these people. I sought them out and I worked with a lot of these people. And she just wanted to hear those stories. And she finally said, you know, in the world of podcasting, we might have something that would be entertaining to people. Let's go on mic and give this a shot. And we what we decided to record a pilot, but we ended up she ended up pulling like I think 20 names out of the hat. We recorded for 3 hours and we had a lot of fun. And we listened to it back and we played it for some people and they said, you know, this is good. This should be out there. And that's pretty much the genesis.
So one of the things that I find interesting is that, you know, you mentioned Sonny Bono and so on, people who in some cases, at least in the episodes I've heard so far, for like the mass audiences, there's a couple names where people go, okay, now who is that again? Right. But as you point out, these are people that kind of wandered into your life in this, how do you, you can't say like, you can't wake up one day and say, I'm going to meet Gene Pitney one of these days. How do you wind up on that path where you're in an elevator with Gene Pitney after a business meeting?
Oh, I woke up every day thinking I was going to meet Gene Pitney. You have to believe, man. No, actually, I produced a record by Arthur Alexander, who was the first person to ever have a hit in Muscle Shoals. And there's actually an exhibit happening right now in Nashville. I forget where it's happening. The Musicians Hall of Fame, maybe? Maybe the Country Music Hall of Fame, about the history of Muscle Shoals. And Arthur is a big part of that exhibit. And Dan Penn and Spooner Oldham just did a couple gigs to promote it. But they all got their start because Arthur had the first hit out of Muscle Shoals. And then he disappeared for about 30 years, 40 years. And Elektra Records hired me to find, not find him, but go to Cleveland and convince him to make a record. And we made a record. It was kind of a comeback record. And it got a lot of attention. This would be like 1993, maybe. And I started getting calls from managers of older legacy artists, and one of them was Gene Pitney's manager. So that's how I ended up in an elevator at Carnegie Hall with Gene Pitney, but not working with him.
And see, I love this because this is this period in the 90s. I mean, people forget, for instance, that, you know, Johnny Cash before those Rick Rubin records, it was just a few years ago, or a few years before that, rather. You know, a friend of mine tells me a story about it. He said, oh yeah, Johnny Cash was, you know, he played the opening of an outlet mall 20 miles down the road from Wichita. And so there was that kind of time in the 90s, for instance, where, I mean, Solomon Burke, so on and so forth, people were kind of reemerging.
I was part of that. It seemed like in the early 90s, there was this appreciation for older artists that wasn't there, like you said, even 2 years before that. Like 1988, Johnny Cash got dropped by Columbia Records in the 80s, you know, which is like, you don't do that. You don't do that. But they did it. His value in the marketplace or in our culture was in limbo. And in the early 90s, for some reason, you know, Johnny Cash and, you know, all these people were given second chance. And I was part of that. I also produced Charlie Feathers, a very eccentric rockabilly artist from Memphis who was retired. I convinced him to make a record. And I really enjoy working with older artists for 2 reasons. One, they represent an era that's not mine, which is fascinating to be around. And also, it makes me feel younger because they're older. So, you know, you're always the kid.
Well, and I would imagine though that many of these artists, there's sometimes, I don't know, maybe sometimes there would be suspicion of something about, you know, along comes this whippersnapper or something, or maybe this person really isn't going to understand my music. So that sense of respect, if you knew the stuff and everything, then that kind of gets built in, right?
Yeah, my enthusiasm is undeniable, you know, like I love music so much, I can't hide it. And so I guess the purity of that kind of love for music is what the older artists noticed about me, I guess. I don't know. I bonded pretty quickly with almost everyone that I, you know, either approached or, you know, was paired up with. And I also just, you know, my love for their music. I mean, the idea of producing a legacy artist is you're making a tribute, you're making an homage to that artist by the artist, like something that celebrates their career, you know, instead of trying to make them go disco or trying to make them be hip or anything like that, you know, just help them remember the best part of themselves and encourage it and set up an environment of trust and great musicians and go over the songs, pick them very carefully and, get very involved in the expression of what the artist is all about.
Yeah, so that time was fertile for you in a number of ways. Working with kind of legacy artists was one way, and then this world that you entered into with scoring for television and so forth. And again, here too, this was not something that 15-year-old Ben was like, "Gosh, I'm going to write music for TV one day."
I fantasized about it because I would always know. I remember when I was a kid watching The Fugitive, and I think I said to my mom, "How come every time they're in a dark alley, you hear bongos? What's up with that?" And my mom was like, "What are you talking about?" So I was ready. I didn't have any training or anything, and I didn't know, like what the hierarchy or like the ladder you would have to climb to get there. I came in sideways because the creators of Third Rock from the Sun heard me being interviewed on the radio and called the station and asked me to come in. So I came in at the executive level of TV music and then found out how it all worked. But they totally picked me and just took a hunch on me.
It's amazing too, because this is a because the music from Third Rock for me is so memorable. But the 90s was also a time, I think, where the music and TV was shifting. Like, I think of
Yeah,
Mike Post's theme to the Rockford Files as being really rocking. But the theme to ER, there's nothing there.
it's true. I can't even hum it. I can't even remember it. What
Yeah.
is it?
Yeah, it's like.
Did they have one? I don't know. Well, I was part of the change because the people who created Third Rock were not from the sitcom world. They were writers for Saturday Night Live. So they didn't know the rules at all about what music is supposed to do, and they heard my music and said, what they basically said was, "We're looking for American classic American rock and roll as if played by aliens, and we think you're already doing that," which I took as a compliment, and they just encouraged me to be as weird as I want. I was very lucky because other sitcoms were very rigid about things, but Third Rock, they wanted it to be odd, and they wanted to have a sound that you could recognize. Like if you went into the kitchen to get a glass of water, when you heard my music, you knew the show was back on and you ran back in. They wanted something that was undeniably Third Rock. And they encouraged me to be weird and do whatever I want. And they loved every idea. I never got any notes. It was amazing.
What did you learn about yourself that you weren't aware of when you got into that world?
I don't know what I learned about myself, but what I did learn is that the first idea has to be the only idea. It rid me of any writer's neurosis because we were going on the air. It was a real deadline. Like they take the music out of your hands and they slap it on the episode, and you're on TV, and 23 million people are watching, and so you don't have time for rewrites or second thoughts. Your first thought has to be the best thought because it's the only thought you're going to have time to have. And that was a great thing for me because I mean I always wrote quickly and I always went with my gut, but this was a real challenge. Can I do it? Can I deliver the amount of music they need and as quickly as they need it? And it was a great experience for me. Like I work really fast because of that experience now, I'm just boom. It was great, but I guess I also learned that there, I considered myself more of a lyricist as far as being a writer. That's what I focused on early on, and to find out that my music without lyrics was the thing that would make the biggest impact was a surprise to me. I didn't realize that that was a talent. Instrumental music was that strong of a talent.
I wonder too, like just to stick with Third Rock because that's familiar to me, but because you have characters who are there every week, I would imagine there are certain cues maybe where you might have a flavor, like the character Tommy on that show or Sally or something. There might be a certain musical flavor to them for you as the
Yeah.
writer.
Oh yeah, that was I learned all about that. Yeah, you have certain themes for people or sounds or it was a great experience. I was really lucky, and then I worked on that 70s show right after. Well, during I did both at the same time actually. Like I was very, very busy for about 12 years in Hollywood, and the studio lot where we shot those shows and had our production offices just went into foreclosure. Like the other day in Variety, it was a big news story, and I'm like, no, there goes my past. It's crazy.
Well, yeah, I mean that is a world that is changing. I mean, I used to talk to people who were like, "Oh yeah, I'm into building libraries," and libraries now, music libraries, they too are potentially threatened.
Yeah, sure. I mean, TV. Well, sitcoms with a live audience, like I worked on, I think there might be one or two on the air like that. Like that format is not. I got in at just the right time. I got in 1995, must see TV, NBC, and Third Rock was part of that. That was the peak, the golden time. And then reality shows and Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, those kind of shows started showing up, and they were cheaper to make. You didn't need writers, allegedly. People were still writing stuff, but and you didn't need four cameras and the whole thing. It was inexpensive and it was popular, and the sitcoms started to be less and less were being filmed and created until by the time I left. My timing was good getting in and getting out, because by the time I left, the production company that produced all of the shows I worked on, they went out of business. So I decided I'm going to go out of business too, because I figured they know something that I don't know. If they're going out of business, I'm getting out too, which is what I did.
That's a phrase that a friend of mine taught me a while back, which is nobody wants to be the last buggy whip salesman.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
it's like when you hear the music changing, then maybe it's time. So that's also leading to this, which is, podcasting is one of those media forms that, didn't exist 30 years ago. And people seem to really be invested in the power of stories, and you definitely had those, so that had to be part of the attractive thing about it too.
Yeah, it sure was. It's great. It's almost like old time radio is back, with podcasts. People really want, during their commutes or when they're going out for a walk, they just download a podcast and listen to something for 45 minutes. And I have a still have an apartment in Santa Monica, a rent controlled apartment, and it's a 3 hour drive from my desert house to Santa Monica. So I became a fan of podcasts, all kinds of podcasts, and I mean, there was one podcast, I can't remember the name of it now, but it was about the assassination attempt on Gerald Ford. And there was like 10 episodes about this, and all of the interchanging parts of that story were fascinating. So when Laura suggested we do a podcast, I was like, yeah, let's give it a shot, because I would love to be part of that.
Now, you have such a wonderful speaking voice. Had you done radio or had aspirations of radio at any point?
I have a syndicated radio show now, actually. It's called The Many Moods of Ben Vaughn. And it's on, I think, 26 stations now. We're out there. It's a 1 hour weekly radio show where I go through my record collection and play stuff and tell stories there. So I was already ready for this, And I've done commentary on Fresh Air too. Terry has me come on. Like when Lee Hazlewood died, I remember they called me up and they needed somebody to talk about Lee Hazlewood. I was in my car at a Home Depot and they're recording my recollections. I never met Lee Hazlewood. I'm just a fan, but they figured I was the guy. So I have experience talking about music in on radio, and I'll talk about music to anyone anywhere. I mean, it's fun.
That's the other thing, I guess, too, is that because of kind of the lane that you were in with production and everything, you were also able to get these stories. And I don't want to give too much away, but for instance, with Lee Hazlewood, this ultimately kind of put you in touch with another hero of yours.
Dwayne Eddy. Dwayne Eddy. Yeah, well, Dwayne Eddy, I talked to him on the phone. I had a great conversation with him on the phone. He set me straight about how he got his guitar sound, because in my tribute to Lee Hazlewood, I got it wrong. And I said that they got his guitar sound by putting his guitar amp in a grain barrel. And his wife found me, Dwayne's wife found me on the internet and hooked up a phone call with Dwayne, because she said that he wanted to set me straight on that, but I got it wrong. So I was I thought he was angry, but he wasn't. He was tickled by the tribute. And then he told me how they actually use water tanks to get that guitar sound. Like they would send a signal into a water tank and then record the reverberation of that tank with a certain amount of water in it, and they would change it depending on how much reverb they wanted. And then they would bring that signal back into the mixing board. And he told me a great story about how he went out with Lee Hazlewood and Al Casey shopping for water tanks in Phoenix. I just think that people need to know that that happened. That a 17-year-old Dwayne Eddy was, went out shopping with Lee Hazlewood, who was probably in his 30s already by then, I'm thinking, to shop for water tanks, and they told him it's going to be great for your career. This water tank is going to make you a star. I mean, and that's great information if you're a music fan.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And there's one other thing that I want to talk about too, is that now again, I've only heard three episodes, but I assume part of this, part of your life in music is that sometimes there are encounters with people that you wouldn't necessarily think of first. Like for instance, that you got to know Ed King of Lynyrd Skynyrd, not being a Lynyrd Skynyrd fan. But
Right.
he became somebody that you knew and kind of admired.
Well, Ed King, I was a what I liked about Ed King is he was in the Strawberry Alarm Clock before Lynyrd Skynyrd. So he had cred. I wasn't a Skynyrd fan, but I loved the Strawberry Alarm Clock. So I was pretty thrilled to meet him. And he was confused when I told him that's why. I mean, he wrote, the riff of Sweet Home Alabama, and I'm talking about incense and peppermint. So it was an odd first meeting. But well, I mean, if you're a musician and you're in and out of recording studios and you're on tour a lot, which I toured constantly, so I shared the bill with a lot of people. I actually did share a dressing room with the Replacements, so I can understand your story about the Coyote Club pulling the plug on those guys. You don't want to share a dressing room with those guys, I'm just saying. You run into people, and if you're paying attention, I guess, and you're amused by details, you're going to have experiences that you're going to remember. You're going to have memorable experiences. And I've luckily have a really good memory, because when Laura pulls those names out of the hat, I don't know what's next, and I have no notes when I do it, none whatsoever. And we were really happy with how much information came out of my brain. I'm always amazed that my brain can do anything, actually. But also how it flowed naturally, even though I was thinking on my feet the entire time. That was a pleasant surprise.
Yeah, the Replacements. My understanding is at one point they had hatched a plot to kind of paint over all the iconic graffiti and dressing rooms in towns that they had visited. So.
Well, that's yeah. Yeah, when the band shows up, with a couple gallons of paint and brushes, that's a sign that it's going to be an interesting evening.
So I've heard these three episodes. Now, what do you see in terms of like how this will develop? Are you doing this like in seasons where it'll be like 12 episodes per season, that sort of thing?
That's how we're viewing it now. We have 12 episodes. It's going to air. Oh, air, whatever you call it. It's going to land, drop, they say, every 2 weeks, which takes us up till June. And we decided we're just going to wait and see what kind of reaction we get and decide whether it's a season or we're just going to, start recording more and keep going or take some time off. We don't even know. We're winging it with this one.
And we get to hear you play music in there as well.
That's right. Every episode ends with a song, with me performing a song, which I wanted to do because that's what Ricky Nelson did at the end of every episode of Ozzie and Harriet. It's a
Amazing.
great tradition. It's a great tradition.
Yeah, it is. And I'm listening, like I think, okay, so I think like I'm, you know, like I have some sort of like deep knowledge of music, and I'm listening to the two of you talk, and I'm hearing about songs like My Dog Cat, and I think I have the title of that right. And so
Yeah, almost. Walking My Cat Named Dog
Walking My Cat.
by Norma Tanaga. Yeah, well, exactly. So Laura is, I don't even know how old she is, but she's, probably 30 years younger than me, I'm guessing. She knows that song. Like, why is that? That's part of why I wanted to do this, because I'm fascinated by her, not only her knowledge of it, but she seems to have a feel for it that is connected in a way you would swear she was around when it was a song, a brand new song. So, her knowledge of obscure music is she's kind of like a savant, I guess,
So that part of me is like, it's like whenever I hear an interview with Robert Plant, I always walk away with like 12 obscure records I've never heard of before. And this is, you know, the two of you talking.
He's one of those guys. He just shot a video where he was at Elektra Records, Nonesuch, and he pulled out the Charlie Feathers record that I produced and talked about it for like 5 minutes. And I'm thinking, wow, because that only came out on CD and it came out in 1990. I mean, and it was out of print about it, like 8 weeks later or something. He has a copy and he knew every song on it. So he is the ultimate geek, really. And it's amazing too, because he's also a credible rock star. Usually you get one or the other. You get a geek who, is a geek, or you get a, like a rock, he's like a combination. He carries both with him,
Yeah.
His musical tastes are amazing.
Yeah, for sure. Well, just two things. You know, the first one kind of a fun question. What do you think Bob Dylan would say or will say about this podcast when he hears it?
Well, he talked about me on his radio show, which is really funny because I used to imitate Bob Dylan when I was in high school, and I had a friend named Bob West, and I would, when we passed each other in a hall, I would say, "Bob West," and he would say, "Ben Vaughn," and we'd laugh, So Dylan played one of my songs on his radio show, and then talked about me, and when he said my name, it sounded like he was imitating Bob West. So I think Dylan would love this show. He loves obscure artists too. His knowledge of music is pretty far out, and I think he would find it amusing, at least, especially when I imitate him.
I don't say nothing like that. So, okay, and then this is a selfish one. So, if I don't know Sonny Bono, aside from I Got You, Babe, where do I need to start?
Wow. Well, the beginning, he worked at Specialty Records, and he produced Don and Dewey and Larry Williams, which are some really hardcore, great R&B stuff. He produced that stuff. He wrote She Said Yeah, that Larry Williams did, and the Stones covered later. He co-wrote Needles and Pins with Jack Nitzsche, which has been covered by everybody at this point. And he worked with Phil Spector. He was Phil's, right-hand man for a while. And then he met Cher and created Sonny and Cher and I Got You, Babe, which he wrote, that, completely came out of his mind, that record, which is a fantastic record. Folk rock with an oboe and a wall of sound thing. I mean, it's just an amazing record. And then he made what really got me into Sonny. In 1967, he made a psychedelic solo album called Inner Views. And the record company took out an ad in the very first issue of Rolling Stone to introduce that Sonny has something heavy to say. And I heard that record and it completely blew my mind because I couldn't tell if it was sincere or not. And I kind of like that. I kind of like when I don't know. I like not knowing. is this person sincere, or are they jumping on the bandwagon? Are they is something a parody or an homage? I don't know. I like not knowing. And that record really delivered on that. And at the same time that record came out, they were showing an anti-drug film in my high school, narrated by Sonny Bono. So he is warning kids about drugs while he's making a psychedelic record. I just love the hypocrisy and of that, you know, like the duplicity of man, I think is what they call that. And I love his arrangements and his record production. The solo records that Cher made early on are incredible. She covers a Ray Davies tune, "I Go to Sleep," on one of them. I'm just a huge fan. And he wrote a lot of songs. He made a lot of 45s under different names as an artist before Sonny and Cher. He had publishing companies and record companies. He was just involved in everything, like a real hustler in the history of rock and roll. And he worked with Sam Cooke, people like that. I mean, he had a huge career, at least a 10-year career before I Got You, Babe. And few people know that. So I kind of feel it's like my job to evangelize about this, you know.
And I know I could look this up, and I know I just have to let you go, but Don and Dewey, that would they have had like some sort of either a Frank Zappa connection or some sort of influence on Frank?
You are correct. Don Sugarcane Harris
That's what it
of
is.
Don and Dewey played electric violin, and Frank Zappa had him in his band, and I think John Mayall had him in his band for a while too. Really great, you know, electric blues violin, really fierce, like digging in stuff, you know, really great.
You've been listening to a conversation with Ben Vaughn. His new podcast with co-host Laura Pocadello, Straight from the Hat with Ben Vaughn, launched on January 22nd. You can find out more about it at straightfromthehat.com and find out more about all his other activities at benvaughn.org. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening, and don't forget that our theme music is composed and performed by Torrin Anderson. We'll see you next time.